entering a new Cold War, when there's not a wave of socialist revolutions threatening American imperialism, when nobody is really challenging U.S. hegemony from the point of view of a revolutionary overturn, why was the war on terror suddenly removed as part of American military doctrine and substituted for it was a new doctrine which said we must prepare now for major power conflict with Russia and China.
That's Brian Becker, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Brian Becker on Cold Wars, Old and New. We're in the midst of a new Cold War. In this go-round, the principal adversary is China, with Russia taking second place. In the old Cold War, it was the reverse. Today, Russia is nowhere near China economically, and Moscow's performance in Ukraine suggests its military has serious problems. China is already an economic superpower and is seen by the U.S. as a long-term threat to its hegemony. Washington's so-called pivot to Asia is aimed at Beijing. Its strategy is to impose sanctions and surround it with more and more bases and to get Australia, Japan, and other countries into military alliances. If the new Cold War either intentionally or unintentionally morphs into a hot one, we can say goodbye to our precious planet. Our guest today is Brian Becker. He's the National Director of the Answer Coalition. Act now to stop war and end racism. He's the host of the Socialist Program podcast. He spoke at KGNU in Boulder, Colorado in mid-September. And now, Brian Becker.
So let's talk about what the first Cold War looked like, what caused it, what some of the impacts or implications of the Cold War were. The first Cold War really shows itself at the beginning of the first Korean War between 1950 and 53, where the Soviet Union, the People's Republic of China, all of the countries in Eastern and Central Europe that had socialist governments sided with North Korea, and the United States and all of the countries that constituted NATO, which was formed in 1949, supported South Korea. So you had a divide in the world, just as you had a divide in the world between 1940 and 1945 in World War II. You had the United States and Britain and the Soviet Union fighting against Germany, Japan, and Italy. The world was divided. And on both sides, there were capitalist countries, or what Marxists or socialists would call imperialist countries. The imperialist countries were fighting each other, just as they fought each other in World War I. And for some of the same reasons, who was going to get market share, what colonies would belong to which metropole. So there was another world conflict in Korea, both the whole world divided again, but instead of it being a battle between capitalist powers and other capitalist powers, this was a war between capitalist governments and socialist governments. So the Cold War was really a war, which in the case of Korea was not cold at all. 4 million Koreans died in the Korean War, according to the Encyclopedia Britannica. That would be one out of every five Koreans. So it wasn't cold for the Koreans. It was very hot. But it was cold in the sense that the Soviet Union and the United States were not killing each other. They were fighting essentially through proxies. And the Cold War resembled this struggle that was a political, geostrategic, but also ideological struggle between two different blocks or camps. One was called communism or socialism, and the other was called capitalism, or as I learned it as a kid, freedom and democracy. But you had this clear demarcation in the first Cold War between governments that represented two diametrically different ideological world orientations, and also two different social systems. The Soviet Union and China, and then the governments of Eastern and Central Europe, they had socialist economies. The old capitalist elites, the ruling class, the corporations had been nationalized. The private property and the means of production had been made public. It was a different social economy, a different social reorganization of society. So if you look at the war that took place, the Cold War, it's between two camps, one communist, one capitalist. Now, there's another element of that Cold War, which was not really ideological, but masked itself as an ideological struggle, which is that the United States, after World War II, became the dominant power for the entire capitalist world. It was the United States that revived the capitalist economy, even in the economies of the defeated countries. The U.S. occupied Japan and Germany, the defeated rivals of the United States, but unlike after World War I, where the victors imposed draconian economic sanctions and reparations on the defeated adversary, in the case of Germany, it was the Versailles Treaty imposing extreme sanctions and reparations on Germany such that the German economy destabilized, which eventually led to the rise and victory of Hitler within 15 years. Unlike that, the United States said to the Japanese and German enemies, we will not only revive you, we will make you rich again. We will revive the corporate elites that we had just been at war with. And so Germany revived. Germany was integrated into the world market. Japan was integrated into the world market. They were not punished, they were revived. But the condition for the revival was that Japan and Germany would then function as essentially junior partners following the leadership of the United States in this new global confrontation, which is a confrontation between capitalism and socialism. So Germany, the United States, Britain, France, and the other countries that constituted NATO, which was formed in 1949, were a bloc of capitalist countries with the understanding that each of them would be given a place, a share in the world economy, as long as they followed the leadership of the United States. That was the quid pro quo in the new post-World War II arrangement. The United States wanted, during that entire period, to make sure that not only the capitalist powers would follow the United States' lead in the struggle against socialism and communism, but that the United States would retain primacy in all of the areas of the world that the United States considered to be primary for U.S. hegemony. And we see that play out all over the place. The coup d'etat against the democratically elected government in Iran that took place in 1953 that brought the Shah to power. That was as a result of the Mossadegh government nationalizing the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, also known as BP. So the United States partnered with Britain, carried out an economic destabilization of the government in Iran, brought into power a dictatorship, the Shah, who then denationalized the oil and returned it to British Petroleum, but 40% then went to Gulf Oil. So the United States, in addition to leading the struggle against communism, was also gaining market share and domination wherever possible and resisting those who tried to challenge that, especially in what was then called the Third World. Same thing happened in 1954. The next year, the United States, the CIA, overthrew the Arbenz government. Arbenz, like Mossadegh, was not a communist, but he dared to nationalize the United Fruit Company and say that the profits of United Fruit should go to lift up the people of Guatemala, bring them out of poverty. And so the United States, under the banner of fighting communism, was actually overthrowing democratically elected governments that were not communist, not socialist, but were trying to use resources that their countries possessed for the elimination of poverty of their own people. So in some ways, the war against communism became pretextual to maintain U.S. domination wherever U.S. corporate interests were challenged even by non-communist forces who wanted to be able to use those resources to alleviate poverty in their own country. There was another feature of that time that we really have to recognize that's so different from today. The differences, we're emphasizing the differences here between this Cold War and the last Cold War. What was the other big difference? Was that after World War II, a wave of revolution swept through Asia. It was not just in Korea, but it was also in Vietnam. It was also in China. The communist parties in Vietnam, in Korea, in China were fighting for power and did take power. There was a revolutionary upsurge in Indonesia, a huge country, today the fourth largest country in the world. The communists were leading the struggle against Dutch imperialism. So the United States targeting of the Soviet Union and China and the socialist camp wasn't simply an ideological struggle, and it wasn't simply a geostrategic struggle. It was a counter-revolutionary struggle because revolution was on the agenda. Most of the people of the world lived in Africa or Asia or the Middle East or Latin America. They had lived under centuries of colonial domination. They wanted to be free people. They were ready to fight for their freedom, and they were fighting for their freedom. So the United States and the imperialist world looked around to all of these parts of the world and said, look, the people in Africa, Asia, Latin America, the Middle East are fighting for freedom to be anti-colonial. And in many of those struggles, the Communist Party was leading the movement. Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam, Kim Il-sung in North Korea. So there really was this wave of revolution. Think about the situation today. Is there a wave of revolution throughout the world that's toppling capitalism? Anything similar to what was happening in the 1940s and 1950s? No, there's not. Is there a Soviet Union that's anchoring a global socialist camp that's explicitly anti-capitalist? No. Is Russia even a socialist country? No. Is Putin a communist? No. Is Putin an anti-communist? Yes. The Chinese Communist Party still retains power in China, but is it trying to export socialist revolution in Asia, in Africa, in Latin America, in the Middle East? No. If you listen to the leadership in China, whether it's Xi Jinping today or earlier Chinese leaderships, their line is not, we're fighting for global socialism and communism against imperialism and capitalism. The Chinese line goes something like this. Let's have a win-win situation in the world whereby we bring our people out of poverty. We bring our people out of the legacy of underdevelopment that you, the West, imposed on us. We rise up. We, in the last 10 years, we, the Chinese, have eliminated extreme poverty, meaning the elimination of a situation where their population, 850 million people in China, were living on less than $2.3 a day. Is that an aggressive policy, a country on the march for global domination or to spread revolution when your main goal is to bring 850 million people, almost triple the number of the U.S. population, out of a situation where they're making less than $2.30 a day? China's not trying to do that. What China's saying is, let's have win-win. Our economic development is not at you, United States, at your expense. Let's have a win-win world. We develop, we grow, our economy gets stronger, our poverty level is diminished, and you, the American capitalist, you get to invest in China and make lots of money by paying Chinese workers a lot less than you would pay the workers in Michigan. Nobody put a gun to the head of American corporations and said, you must go and invest in China. They did it because there was a lot of money to be made. This is not like 1945, 1946, 1950 at all, when you think about it in those terms. So even though we have Kim Jong-un meeting with Putin in Russia, and Nicolas Maduro, who is the president of Venezuela, also targeted by the United States, in the same week meeting in China with Xi Jinping, and Russia says to North Korea, we want to forge a military partnership with you. And Xi Jinping says to Maduro, we are now elevating Venezuelan-Chinese relationship to a strategic partnership. That seems symmetrical in some ways with the first era of Cold War, but think about all the differences. There's not a wave of revolution. It's not socialism and communism on the march. It's not the Soviet Union anchoring a socialist camp. And it's not China trying to promote world revolution. Big differences, right? So how is it, why is it under these circumstances that we have this kind of symmetry or seeming symmetry between the new Cold War and the old Cold War when there are such obvious differences? Why are we entering a new Cold War when there's not a wave of socialist revolutions threatening American imperialism, when nobody is really challenging U.S. hegemony from the point of view of a revolutionary overturn? What's the reason that the United States in 2018 decided that the war on terror, which was the military doctrine and priority of the Pentagon and all of the U.S. government from 2001, September 11th, all the way up until 2018, why was the war on terror suddenly removed as part of American military doctrine and substituted for it was a new doctrine which said we must prepare now for major power conflict with Russia and China. If Russia is not communist and China is not promoting world revolution and really just wants to be integrated into the world economy, why is the United States suddenly shift away from the war on terror and prepare instead for war with China and Russia? Because that's what's happened. I mean, it's quite something, isn't it? They said that in 2018. Obama had announced the pivot to Asia in 2011. When he did that, people were like, what's the pivot to Asia? It was pretty unclear. He didn't clarify what it meant. Well, we now know that what it meant was to place 60% of U.S. Air Force and naval assets into the Pacific. We should have, if we were paying attention, when Obama said there's a pivot to Asia, we should think, when else has the United States pivoted to Asia? It pivoted to Asia in 1899 when it invaded the Philippines. That was a pivot to Asia. 1 million Filipinos died. 1 million as the U.S. invaded the Philippines. It pivoted to Asia at the end of, or at the beginning of August in 1945 when it dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. 5 years later, it pivoted to Asia with the invasion of Korea. 8 years later, it pivoted to Asia with the invasion of Vietnam. Whenever the U.S. has pivoted to Asia in the last 125 years, it's been pretty bad for Asians. The pivot to Asia almost always means a pivot to war with Asia. And so now we can see, since 2018, that what was somewhat unclear when Obama announced the pivot to Asia is now clear. I went through a list of headlines that are in the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New York Times, every major media outlet. You'll get this drift right away. You'll sense a certain degree of repetition. Wall Street Journal, U.S. not ready for war with China. Washington Post, U.S. Navy not ready for war with China. New York Times, U.S. Marines not yet ready for war with China. Every headline is like why the U.S. isn't ready for war with China. There's no headlines like war with China would be a really bad idea. War with China is lunacy. War with China is so absurd. That headline is nowhere. As a matter of fact, if you argue, as we do in the Answer Coalition, war with China is lunacy, it is a bad idea, it should be rejected. And because China also says that war with China and the United States is bad, the new McCarthyism, like the old McCarthyism, says, you, the Answer Coalition, or other groups, you're echoing and repeating Chinese talking points when you say that you're against war between the United States and China. And why would you be echoing and repeating these Chinese talking points You must be an agent of China. And in fact, that's what's happening right now. The New York Times and other media, Marco Rubio in Congress, is demanding that organizations like the ones that we're talking about be held to account for not registering as foreign agents for China. I'm serious. When the New York Times is writing to me over and over again, why aren't you a registered foreign agent for China? Like, because we're not agents of China. We're people in the United States who actually are exercising something called our First Amendment rights of free speech to disagree with the U.S. government policy. In that sense, the new McCarthyism is starting to resemble the old McCarthyism. So the question today is, why, given the differences between today and the post-World War II era, are we in a position where the U.S. has decided that the main number one priority for targeting, for prioritizing military strategy, for contingency, for budgeting, should be to get ready for major power conflict with Russia and China? Why is that? It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense on one level. But the thing is about it that it evolved as a consensus position. There was no debate in Congress. I didn't see Bernie Sanders or the more liberal wing of the U.S. Congress getting up and saying major power conflict is absolute ridiculousness. The Squad, there's a little tiny group of liberals in the American Congress. They haven't spoken up against this. The Democratic establishment is all for it. The Republican establishment, in spite of the fact that Trump demagogically pretends to be sort of anti-war on some things, that's all BS. The Republicans and the Democrats are just as committed to major power conflict. I think the United States feels that its grip on authority or domination over the entire world is slipping, not because there's a wave of socialist revolutions, but because China's emergence as a major economy and Russia getting back on its feet after the disaster following the collapse of the Soviet Union has taken two big countries and put them into an independent political position in relationship to the U.S. They are independent countries. They're not fighting for revolution, but they are big enough, strong enough, resource-rich enough, and not part of the U.S. sort of network that they can constitute an alternative to the domination of the world by U.S. and Western imperialism. But then think about the BRICS countries, not just China and Russia. BRICS is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And now there's six new members of BRICS that just were brought in at the recent summit of BRICS. And I don't know if I can remember them all, but it included Iran, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates. And my point is that those countries, even before the addition of the new six members, and many, many more countries want to join BRICS, those countries' aggregate GDP, gross domestic product, is in total greater than the GDP of the G7. It's greater. So China, India, Russia, South Africa, Brazil, by themselves without the other six, have more in terms of the share of world production than the G7. The U.S. could see that and see that these are emerging economies. And as they emerge, they don't want to live under the dictate of the United States financial system. You know how BRICS got started? It was not a decision to form an anti-imperialist bloc. India, which is the largest producer of pharmaceutical goods, because Western companies, monopoly companies, have the patents, but the medicines are produced in India. Well, India was talking to Brazil and South Africa in 2003 when a wave of AIDS deaths were ravaging the populations in Brazil and South Africa. And India was asked by Brazil and South Africa to give them or sell them the HIV cocktail so that their masses of people wouldn't keep dying. And India could not sell them the medicines that they produced because they didn't own the patents. They didn't have the intellectual property rights. Those are maintained by the Western capitalist monopoly pharmaceutical corporations. So here you had the biggest producer of pharmaceutical goods unable to sell medicine that would save the lives of other emerging economies because of the domination of Western capitalist countries. So the beginning of BRICS was really the beginning of an effort by emerging economies whose GDP is really growing and growing and growing dynamically, not to be under the dictates of the international rules-based order, whereby a few Western countries and a handful of Western monopoly corporations get to decide everything. India wasn't trying to promote revolution, and Brazil wasn't trying to promote revolution, and South Africa wasn't. They wanted to buy AIDS drugs, and they couldn't because of the way the world economy is organized. So BRICS was the beginning of a process whereby large emerging economies were trying to create a diversified world economy. That's different than fighting for socialism. They did not have a vision of a world free of capitalism. They wanted a world capitalist system that had a level playing field so that countries in the former colonized part of the world or semi-colonized part of the world would be able to grow and emerge and overcome poverty and underdevelopment. And what did the United States do during this period? When the Soviet Union was gone, when the Soviet Union was no longer a rival power, what did the United States do? Did it say, as some people were told in 1989 and 1990 when the Cold War was coming to end, that we're going to have a peace dividend, that we don't have to keep spending this level of military, this level of money on missiles and bombs and bullets? Now we can build bridges and have more money for public colleges and get rid of student debt, and that was the peace dividend, right? But the U.S. saw the end of the Soviet Union and the collapse of the socialist camp, the collapse of a counterpole, as an opportunity to go to war against Iraq and Libya and Syria. And they were hoping to go to war against Iran, and they were hoping to go to war against North Korea. George W. Bush said it on January 29th, 2002, there's an axis of evil in the world, and the axis of evil is Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. 1 year before that, Madeleine Albright, who was Bill Clinton's Secretary of State, was in Pyongyang, the North Korean capital, negotiating with the North Korean leadership at that time, and it looked like there would be a normalization or a possible normalization of relations with North Korea. So Bush comes in, September 11th happens, and Bush gets up and says, no, we're not going to have normal relations with North Korea. We're going to destroy North Korea, and we're going to destroy Iraq and Iran because they're evil. They're the axis of evil. So the U.S. goes to war in Afghanistan, goes to war in Iraq. North Korea immediately leaves the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, and says, okay, we're done with that. We're going to start building nuclear weapons because we're not going to be invaded like Iraq was. And North Korea does become a nuclear power. And the U.S. spent the next 15 years bogged down fighting the Taliban, fighting the Iraqi resistance, going to war in Libya, spending so much money and time arming right-wing fascist Islamic forces in Syria to topple the Assad government. And during this whole time that the U.S. is spending $5 trillion for endless war in the Middle East under the banner of war on terror, China just keeps growing and growing, and India growing, and Brazil growing, and the U.S. isn't able to pay attention to them because it's bogged down in endless war in the Middle East based on what? Did the U.S. have to go to war in all these countries? No, this was arrogance. Arrogance. This was hubris.
You're listening to Brian Becker on Cold Wars, Old and New. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or go online or website alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
As a socialist, I identify war as the byproduct of a social system, capitalism. But that doesn't mean human beings don't make decisions. And that doesn't mean human beings